know, just as co-workers, actually.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about your connection to this station, this frequency, which has been around for nearly a century, and your family connection goes back a long ways.
Yes, it does. My father was an engineer here for many, many years. He retired in 1975, and a lot of the history that was associated with the station he was a part of, and I carried on with the family tradition of insanity of being in radio. I remember I was teaching a course out at Husson, Introduction to Mass Communications, and Dave McLaughlin called, and he said, Barry, would you be willing to lecture my class? And I said, sure, I'd love to. So I went out. Here are all these young, eager faces sitting there looking at me, and I'm thinking, what in hell can I tell them? Let's see. So I thought for a bit, and I sat on that stool and said nothing. Dave introduced me, and I just sat there for 30 seconds. I said, okay, all right. And then I said, see that door over there? Leave while there's still time.
but she is a powerful mistress, this radio. You have spent much of your life involved in the broadcasting business.
Most of my life, yeah. I did a short time schlepping phones back in when cell phones first became popular, but I said, nah, I want to get back into radio. So the illness stayed with me.
Yeah, you know? Well, I understand that. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Was it Thompson Guernsey that was responsible for getting this signal on the air originally? Yeah.
Tom was a ham, a radio amateur, and the station's transmitter was Tom Guernsey's original ham rig, which was later adapted for broadcast use. And there were a lot of things back then that were rather catastrophic on a day-to-day basis, of, you know, just from a technology viewpoint of keeping the damn thing working. Yeah, it was Tom's ham rig. It went on the air as WLBC on the 30th of December, 1926.
Wow.
So it was quite a while. It was originally in Dover Foxcroft, and it moved to Bangor, right on this very site right here. In fact, this little building out in the back where the transmitter is, was the original... was a little building, a little tiny building.
And that was around 1930, maybe, that was built?
No, that was 26, I believe.
Oh, wow.
The transmitter has been here at 861 for all that time.
Wow.
So a lot of the gear back then was homemade because the typical manufacturers like RCA, GE, and others, they weren't producing a lot of equipment, and what they produced was very expensive.
So this was one of the first stations in the state of Maine to go the air.
Yeah, absolutely. The only ones I can remember that preceded it were WABI in 1924 and WCSH in Portland in 1925. By the way, CSH was a good example of call letters standing for something.
Right.
Congress Square Hotel.
That's right.
And Tom kept possession of this place until 44, I'm sorry, when he was in debt to the Rhines family for quite a lot of money. And so they said, okay, Tom, you can't pay the bill, we'll take the station, which is basically what happened. Yeah, so the station went through a number of power changes, and the last one was in September of 1943 when they went to 5 kilowatts, which is the power it is now.
Right, right.
A couple of things I remember. I was 6, I think, and I used to come out with my father just to be in the radio. So the bug bit that early. Just total insanity. Anyway, he let me turn on the filament switch to the tubes in the transmitter.
Oh, wow.
Which was a real gas. I mean, it was a lot of fun back then. And then, you know, that was my first experience in radio. One funny thing happened with the old Western Electric transmitter that was here, put in 1941 or two, I believe. They had a very large power supply in the back of it, and rats used to get in every once in a while. So there's this bar that went across, and it was hot, 13,000 volts.
Whoa.
Okay. This rat starts across, and you about all that was left was a tail and some fur.
Oh, dear.
And a skeleton. But the poor thing, it didn't live long. It didn't suffer for very long, let's put it that way. I want to call you and everyone else's attention to some work I did at the university.
Yes, I'm glad you want to bring that up because that's so great.
Well, it's a comprehensive history of WLBZ going back to the very beginning in 1926 and a brief discussion of Tom's ham radio setup back then. It covers the area through to the early 1980s, and it consists of 88 library boxes.
Wow.
Full of stuff. Countless hundreds of documents and a lot of memorabilia, over 400 audio recordings that came from 16-inch transcriptions and, you know, other sources. There was a lot of there were a lot of sources used back then. One of them was wire recordings,
right?
And there are some. I think there were several recordings of those. And you can find this, a brief and small part of the total collections in the Digital Commons.
Yes, and I've listened to some of those recordings, and they're fantastic.
Yes, they are. That's right. Yeah, they have the recordings up there, that, and as I said, there were about 400 recordings.
Wow.
And just go to Digital Commons and type in WLBZ Radio Station Records.
That's wonderful.
And it's in there, and it's a marvelous collection, and I was so privileged and pleased to be the person who put it all together.
Well, we appreciate the work that you've done to preserve that history, because you know, with this station signing off in a few days, we lose such a big part of Maine radio history.
That's right. I feel like I'm at a eulogy.
Well, it is. It certainly is, in a sense. Yeah. We were chatting, our friend Brian Netto was in a couple of weeks ago and talking about his mom, Bev, working here.
Oh, she's Bev's a peach.
Thinking about some of those great names from back in the day of Don Clark and Eddie Owen and some of the people that were here through the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of different people who went through here. You're talking about people in a marvelous era, Eddie and Irving Hunter and Ed Guernsey, who I learned to have a great deal of respect for. I thought he was an old curmudgeon back when I worked for him back in the late 60s. But as I went through all of these records and his meticulous, happens a lot lately. I'm 85 in it, about every 10 minutes. What? Who?
Hey, I'm 19 years younger. That happens to me about every 15 minutes. So.
Yeah, there were great people back then.
Yeah.
And, oh, Lord, there are so many stories about this station. It would. I wish I had a couple of days just to go over some of the things, you know, on the air. A couple of days, but that would get pretty boring after a while.
Well, not to me. I love the stories because, like you, I got that radio bug early and I listened to all the stations. In this market as a kid, sat in bed with my transistor radio listening to stations on skips from all around the country.
Yeah. It's kind of sad to go across the AM band right now and there's nowhere near as many stations as there were. And all of them are pretty much doing the same thing, conservative radio, talk radio, and sports. And other than that, there are maybe one or two stations I've heard recently that were playing any kind of music at all.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's the passing of an era, Rich.
It is. And things change. But I think it's important to remember the past and what got us here. Because when we were talking before we came on about podcasts and things like that, and that is maybe the next step in radio's evolution. But none of it possible without these pioneering stations like this one that go back 98 years.
Absolutely. One person I neglected to mention, and I'll do so now, Hal Wheeler.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Hal was a very substantial part of the station back then. And Hal's still around.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. I speak with him every once in a while. He was a real pro.
Well, so many came through these doors through all the years.
Yeah. One quick story
please.
Back in the 40s, the station used to broadcast a show called the Blue Ribbon Minstrels. You'd never get away with a show like that now. And rightfully so.
Right.
It was another time.
Yep.
They used to take the show on the road occasionally. So they went down on one instance to the Samoset in Rockport, Rockland, whichever. And the boys in the band, they'd get up pretty well juiced up during the gig, you know. So Eddie and Irving would try to get them back onto the bus. They were putting the people back onto the bus from the front. They figured out how to get the back door open.
They went
right out the back door and went back to the bar. And I guess it was like several trips
before my goodness.
They could get all of them back again. Yeah, that was a great time.
The glory days of radio, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, again, you can check out some of the wonderful work that Barry has done at the University of Maine, the Digital Commons as well. Barry, it's so great to have you. I appreciate you coming in and sharing just a little bit of this history.
My pleasure, Rich. Anytime.
It's Barry Darling with us here on Downtown. We are at 18 minutes after 4 o'clock. Take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk with Tim Bissell, the three-pint stance. Later, Steve Buckley of The Athletic, Christopher Price of the Boston Globe. Tomorrow on the program, Mighty John Marshall, This Day in Rock and Roll History. Joe Riccio with Shut Up and Eat. The Night Show's Danny Cashman. John Shields with a little Maine hockey preview. And our friend at Radioactive's Kenjamin Franklin. Next week, the final countdown of Downtown and WZON, David Roth of Defector, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, Sean McAdam from Mass Live, our friend Gary Tangway, Dennis Price, and a gathering of all of our former producers, co-hosts, and assorted miscreants that made this show possible for all these years coming up next week on Downtown. We'll take a little break and be back right after this on Z62.
Hey, this is Tim Matheson from Virgin River. You're listening to Downtown with Rich Kimmel.